Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game.
This is a tragedy for many lives, and it will take all of us some time to come to grips with the full magnitude of all the damage that has been done.
As Penn State University interim president Rodney Erickson struggled to comprehend the enormity of the Penn State sex abuse scandal, the investigation widened. Ahead on Only a Game, we'll have the latest news from State College. Also ahead, meet the man who shot 1 million free throws to support military veterans, a remembrance of heavyweight champion Joe Frazier, and the new biography of sports broadcaster Howard Cosell. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Public awareness of what has become known as the Sandusky scandal began with the arrest of Jerry Sandusky, former assistant football coach at Penn State, a week ago. In a news conference on Tuesday, Pennsylvania Attorney General Linda Kelly announced Sandusky's indictment on 40 criminal counts in connection with his alleged sexual assaults against children.
Some of those assaults allegedly occurred while Sandusky was a coach at Penn State, while others happened on the Penn State campus and elsewhere after Sandusky had retired from his coaching position.
Sandusky met at least some of the alleged victims through Second Mile, a program he founded to help troubled boys. Following Sandusky's arrest, Penn State Athletic Director Tim Curley and University Vice President Gary Schultz were charged with failing to alert police to complaints against Sandusky and with lying to a grand jury investigating the assaults. In 2002, both men had learned from then-graduate assistant and current assistant coach Mike McQuarrie, who was placed on administrative leave yesterday, that McQuarrie had witnessed Jerry Sandusky allegedly sexually assaulting a 10-year-old boy. On Wednesday, head football coach Joe Paterno, who had announced that he would retire at the end of the season, was fired, as was the president of the university, Graham Spanier. I'm joined now by Pat Forty of Yahoo Sports, who has been in State College, Pennsylvania, covering this story. Pat, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Bill. I wish you were under happier circumstances.
I do as well. Mike McQuarrie, now an assistant coach, then a graduate assistant, witnessed one assault that occurred at Penn State in 2002. Assess Penn State's responsibility for these alleged crimes.
Well, yeah, I think that Penn State bears a great deal of responsibility given the number of people within the school who either saw firsthand or were consulted or apprised of this and never got around to doing anything substantive. You know, you can start with Mike McQuarrie and move up the line athletically to Joe Paterno, to athletic director Tim Curley, and then beyond that administratively to Vice President Gary Schultz, to President Graham Spanier. All of these people had concerns brought to them, one way or the other, about Jerry Sandusky. Nobody did enough to stop him, to remove him from campus or anything. And even outside of the realm of sports and administration, there were janitors who witnessed another event, allegedly, and did nothing about it. So it is a complete, I think, institutional failure.
Pat, you have written about, quote, the danger in the cult of personality dynamic in college sports. How has that dynamic become evident at Penn State?
You know, Joe Paterno consolidated so much power that nobody at the school could tell him what to do. And while he had a remarkable run of doing great things, of philanthropy and generosity and great graduation rates and staying clear of NCAA problems and winning a lot of football games. But not even all of that, I think, should grant a man complete reign to do as he pleases in a university setting. There need to be checks and balances on everyone, I think, in situations like that, a dictatorship, even a benevolent dictatorship, can be a dangerous thing. And I think we saw it in this instance, that there was nobody really that could rouse the level of outrage needed to do something about what was going on in Joe Paterno's program. Jerry Sandusky was no longer employed there in 2002 when Mike McCreary allegedly witnessed the sexual assault, but it was in his building and on his watch, and nothing happened.
So is the mindset in a case like that just, I'll take care of this, don't worry about it, I'm big enough to handle it?
You know, actually, the funny thing is I think it was almost the opposite, at least according to what we know right now, was the one time Joe Paterno abdicated his absolute power was in this instance, when he basically just played middle manager and passed the buck to Tim Curley. And Tim Curley may have said, don't worry, I'll take care of this. And clearly it didn't get taken care of.
As more people have read about Penn State's failure to respond appropriately to the accusations against Mr. Sandusky, there have been suggestions and demands that Penn State should suspend football as of now. But today's home game against Nebraska will apparently go on. Should it?
You know, I have really strong mixed emotions about that. I understand. I mean, certainly I think we all understand the extreme gravity of the situation. I tend to look at the players who have had nothing to do with this and think that they should be allowed to play their last home game, some of them their last game ever in a Penn State uniform. You know, how the fans react will be interesting to watch. You know, I don't think Penn State students have covered themselves in glory this week. Maybe this will give them a chance to show some better perspective at the game and tribute maybe to the victims of these crimes, the alleged victims. But I think the players probably deserve to play.
Pat, you came into State College from the outside this week. Describe the scene as you found it.
Well, you know, it's been really interesting, Bill. Just the it seems to have metamorphosed as the week has gone on and gone from being people being ashamed and hurt to now they're angry. And I don't think that's necessarily a healthy metamorphosis because they're angry that Joe Paterno isn't the coach, it seems like, as much as anything. And again, I don't have a big enough sample size to say that is the mood here, but that is part of the mood. That is one mood here. I think there's probably many conflicting moods, but you know, there's anger at the media. There's anger at the administration, the Board of Trustees, for getting rid of Joe Paterno. I don't necessarily feel and see enough anger towards Jerry Sandusky at this point, or towards the school hierarchy that allowed Jerry Sandusky to do what he allegedly did.
On Friday, it came out that Sandusky may also face criminal charges in Texas. Do you anticipate the story widening beyond Pennsylvania and Texas?
You know, you don't know. I mean, usually in these situations, and I am not an expert, but usually there are other victims beyond what is known, and some of those may come out. You know, according to the Harrisburg paper, which has done a lot of great work on this, there is a ninth alleged victim now. The grand jury brought up eight, and there's now allegedly a ninth, and you tend to think there may be more that are going to come out. So, you know, it's amazing. You know, so much has happened in 1 week, but at the same time, I think we're a long way from knowing exactly where this story's going.
Making predictions in a circumstance like this is difficult, but do you have a sense of how the new president and others at Penn State are going to be able to handle this disgrace going forward?
No, because we don't even know who the new president is. You know, I thought the Board of Trustees showed certainly a willingness to take a major step, and that was important, you know, and a radical step, and to get rid of Joe Paterno and get rid of Graham Spanier, the president. But now we've got to see who is the new leadership going to be and what is going to be, I guess, the vision going forward. And you know, does it affect how big Penn State football is? It was permitted to become a very, very, very big deal here. And until this incident, we thought it was, you know, a huge mechanism for good in the community and in the state here. Now I think there's question whether it has been. Obviously, it hasn't been for good completely. And you have to, I think, wonder if the benefits outweigh the costs or not from this episode.
Pat, there is a phrase that the NCAA uses called lack of institutional control. And sometimes when that lack of institutional control is extreme, they impose something called the death penalty, which means the program ceases to exist for a year or 2 years, something like that sometimes. It's hard to imagine an instance of worse lack of institutional control than this one. Is the NCAA likely to get involved at some point?
No, very unlikely, actually. You know, and again, the NCAA sometimes is hamstrung by its own procedural bylaws and that sort of thing. They deal with rules violations, most of which are absolutely picayune in comparison to what's been alleged here. You know, it's funny. I mean, people have said, can they put them on probation? No, some of these people are going to get worse. It's going to be called jail, most likely. You know, for Tim Curley and Gary Shultz, they at least face the possibility of that. And possibly for others. You know, I think there's a real chance that the president, Graham Spanier, ends up being charged in this as well. And we'll see who else gets pulled into the fray.
Pat Forty writes about college football and basketball for Yahoo Sports. Pat, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Reporter Cliff White is also in State College, Pennsylvania. He's covering the Penn State scandal story for the Center Daily Times. Cliff, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
How would you characterize the mood in State College in anticipation of today's Senior Day game against Nebraska?
There's a lot of different emotions going into the game. There's certainly a lot of anger that may come out tomorrow, a lot of support for the alma mater among alumni and students. Folks are going to be seeing a football game in which Joe Paterno is not going to be on the sidelines for the first time in 61 years. So it's definitely going to have a different feel than an average Saturday in Happy Valley. But in the long term, this is a football town, and folks are not abandoning their team here.
Was it a good idea to go ahead and play this game?
I think we'll have to see what happens, how the fans react. It's a home game, so you're going to see a mix of reactions in the crowd, and it's not all going to be rah-rah Penn State. But I don't think that it's going to get out of hand. I don't think it's going to become unruly. I think we're going to see blue out, blue being the color of support for sex abuse victims. Student body might sit during the alma mater, especially in the part of the song that says, "May no act of ours bring shame."
One of the things that's happened as a result of the terrible stories that have come out of this scandal this week is people have criticized the so-called cult of personality that sometimes emerges around a head football coach at a Division I program. Is it fair to characterize the reaction or relationship people have had to Joe Paterno that way?
I think so. Until now, it was okay for there to be a cult of personality, a so-called cult of personality around Joe Paterno because the program was so spotless. It was held up as the cleanest program in Division I athletics, and that certainly allowed that cult of personality to build up around Joe Paterno. And I mean, you could see that even up to the day he was let go by the university. He was calling his own shots till the end.
How does Penn State University begin to go about rebuilding its reputation?
I think they've already started. I think the Board of Trustees' actions on Wednesday started that. I think that it won't really start healing itself until these court cases are decided one way or another. As long as Jerry Sandusky continues to live in this community, to have that is continuing this scandal into the foreseeable future.
Cliff White is covering the Penn State scandal for the Center Daily Times, and he joined me from State College. Cliff, thank you for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a new biography of that prince of pomposity, that swaggering, sometimes staggering savant, Howard Cosell. But first, in January 2010, we first reported on Dave Cummings and his quest to make 1 million free throws to raise money for U.S. military veterans and their families. Yesterday, on Veterans Day, the New Hampshire resident completed his 2-year project right on schedule at the Basketball Hall of Fame. Only a Game's Doug Trabue was there.
Dave Cummings has made an average of more than 1,300 foul shots every day since Veterans Day 2009. Friday, Cummings walked onto the court at the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts, for his final trip to the free throw line, 1,000 shots away from his goal. The 44-year-old, who has a full-time job in public relations, came up with the idea as a way to pay tribute to U.S. military veterans and raise money to help wounded vets and their families. Cummings calls the project Hoops for Heroes, and his slogan has been 1 million shots, endless gratitude.
And I know that almost sounds cliche, but it's really how I feel. And that's the part that just, even though the basketball will be gone and the shots will be gone, I want that second half, the gratitude piece, to continue.
Hall of Fame CEO John DeLiva says Hoops for Heroes is one of the most creative uses of basketball he's ever seen.
He really represents each and every one of us that aren't in a Hall of Fame or aren't quote-unquote heroes. And each and every Hall of Famer would believe that their efforts and their accomplishments pale in terms of comparison to a veteran who's on the front lines or someone that's lost their lives defending our country.
Tom Satch Sanders played on 8 championship teams for the Boston Celtics between 1960 and 1973 and was inducted into the Hall of Fame this year. The Celtics had Cummings shoot during a timeout at the Boston Garden in 2010. Friday, Sanders and a team official presented Cummings with a Celtics jersey with the number 1M. Sanders says too many people assume the government or big charity organizations are the only groups capable of helping veterans.
But then you come up with a gentleman like Dave Cummings and you see him reach out and find something special to do as an individual. And then it makes you begin to take a look at yourself and say, you know, what could I do?
One of Cummings' inspirations has been Mark Dakota, a Waterville Valley, New Hampshire resident who was killed in January while serving in the Army in Afghanistan. Dakota's family was on hand Friday, and his father, also named Mark, says they've received a lot of support from their community, and he hopes Hoops for Heroes will motivate others to do the same for veterans.
To be there for the people who are wounded, and for just the people who have served, to let them know that we appreciate them is so important. And we know that now not only from my family's service, but from the loss of our son, we know how important that is.
Cummings gives all of the money he raises to the Intrepid Fallen Heroes Fund, a charity focused on U.S. military veterans and their families. The group's projects include funding the construction of a $60 million medical center in Bethesda, Maryland, for veterans with traumatic brain injuries. When we first spoke in 2010, Cummings was about to knock down his 100,000th shot. His goal was to raise $1 million, and he was confident he'd make it. But even with the Hall of Fame donating a portion of Friday's ticket sales, the total Cummings has raised will be nearly $70,000. Cummings admits he thought bringing in money would be easy.
I'll shoot and the fundraising will take care of itself, but that's a job unto itself. And I was not equipped to do that. And, you know, at the end of the day, I would say that's a small disappointment, but the more than 1,000 and maybe as many as 1,500 individual contributions means a lot.
Cummings makes about 90% of his shots and with one ball and one rebounder can knock down about 800 an hour. In 2010, just 2 months into the project, Cummings already had a clear understanding of the impact Hoops for Heroes would have on his schedule, but he was looking forward to the challenge.
I honestly think of it as a privilege to do this. It's fun, and I'm not thinking about 1 million. I'm thinking about the trip to 1 million, and it is a great trip.
Friday morning, with the crowd of about 150 people on its feet, counting down the number of shots left, Dave Cummings reached his destination. After the final shot, Cummings took a minute to reflect about what Hoops for Heroes really meant to him.
What I always think of is September 12th, the spirit of September 12th. I always think of unity, and that's what I wanted to create in some small way with this project, is to have a bunch of people with a common purpose for something good.
Then he went back to thanking all the people who'd come, who were lining up to thank him. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
Joe Frazier was perhaps best known for being Muhammad Ali's opponent in 3 memorable fights. He became the undisputed heavyweight champion in 1970. He defeated Ali in the putative fight of the century the following year at Madison Square Garden. On Monday, Joe Frazier died of liver cancer. He was 67 years old. I'm joined now by Richard Hoffer, whose remembrance of Frazier appeared on SI.com earlier this week. Richard, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
Frazier fought when Muhammad Ali and George Foreman were in their prime. Would you say he was unfortunate that there were so many accomplished heavyweights available and that he'd have been more appreciated if he'd come along either a little bit earlier or a little bit later?
Possibly, but I think without Ali or Foreman, we wouldn't be talking about him at all. He's going to be remembered not so much as a foil, but as an accomplice of Ali's, I suppose. Without those three Ali fights, I don't think we'd be talking about Joe Frazier in any historical context. I mean, that epic trilogy is what made his career, and possibly Ali's for that matter.
Well, that judgment notwithstanding, Frazier lost to Ali twice. He beat him once, but he did do an awful lot of winning in the ring as well. What accounted for the success he had?
Well, he was a one-of-a-kind guy. I mean, he was one of the top 10 heavyweights of all time, no question, regardless of those losses to Ali. But his smothering style, his relentless, grueling, workmanlike approach to boxing made him a pretty formidable foe in any event.
Would you call the Ali-Frazier rivalry the greatest in boxing's history?
Oh, without question. I mean, there's nothing to compare it to. I mean, even today, it's kind of a catchphrase, you know, that was good, but it was no Ali Frazier. Those three fights will stand the test of time. And it was as much a matter of personality as it was their physical styles that gave this trilogy such an afterlife that I don't think will ever be surpassed.
Much has been made over the years of the antipathy between Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali, who insulted Frazier's intelligence, called him a gorilla. Were the differences between the two former champions settled before Joe Frazier died?
You know, not really. I mean, they had some fake reconciliations, and then they'd move apart again. And, you know, to their dying days, I don't think they ever got over each other. Frazier, for one, he would have been willing to, but he just could not get past the ugliness that Ali presented during those fights. It was Frazier who made possible the split in that first fight. They each got $2.5 million, and Ali was virtually broke. And so you can imagine Frazier's puzzlement. All of a sudden, Ali's going on the warpath, declaring him an Uncle Tom, and he was baffled as much as he was hurt, I think.
Is there a particular a phrase, a moment, an image that you can come up with in terms of how we should remember Joe Frazier?
Well, I think we have to remember him in that thrill in Manila. They call the first fight the fight of the century, but it's the thrill in Manila, the third fight that Ali won, that I think we'll remember as one of the greatest heavyweight fights of all time. It was one of the most vicious and grueling fights ever, and Frazier was giving no quarter, and I think he would have gone out there to his death.
Richard Hoffer is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated and the author of Something in the Air, American Passion and Defiance in the 1968 Mexico City Olympics. Richard, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Angie Dundee, Ali's trainer right next to me, is saying it. You may hear him. Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier!
The man making that call at ringside when Joe Frazier fell to the fists of George Foreman on January 22, 1973, was Howard Cosell. He called numerous championship fights, and he helped build Monday Night Football, which he co-hosted for years, into an exceptionally lucrative phenomenon. He was characterized as, quote, the most hated man in America for a time. And in a new biography, Mark Hrabowski credits Howard Cosell with, quote, transforming American sports. Mark Hrabowski joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome back to Only a Game.
How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Mark, some of our listeners will recall Howard Cosell as a pontificating presence in the Monday Night Football booth, but help us understand how he got his start in broadcasting.
Well, he came up at a time when that kind of approach was completely verboten. It had never been seen before. It was in the 50s, when sportscasters were basically the lapdogs of the teams, the leagues, the commissioners, the sponsors on the networks. Weren't there to make any waves. They were there basically to say how great these leagues were and how great the owners were and how great everything was. I don't really know how he ever made it, to tell you the truth, because he wasn't only fighting those stereotypes. He was fighting, as he pointed out many times, the inbred structure of anti-Semitism in the industry then in the 50s. There were very few Jews on the air and fewer who sounded Jewish the way Cosell did. He laid the groundwork in the 50s by climbing the company ladder at ABC. He was very fortunate that ABC took note of him because ABC was the only network that could have possibly allowed for the ascendance of a Howard Cosell.
You give us an image of Howard Cosell's earliest days broadcasting, and he's laboring, carrying this enormous piece of recording equipment on his back. Yeah. Have I got that right?
Yeah, 40-pound tape recorder, which no one ever used before. You had to plug it in wherever you went. And he used to lug this on his back. I don't really know. I mean, he must look like Quasimodo lugging this thing around from locker room to locker room. And, of course, the resistance he faced because of that was immense. Just the fact that he was from TV. TV very rarely covered baseball, football, you know. I mean, they covered the games, but they didn't really cover it as news events. They didn't have, you know, there was no CNN, there was no ESPN back then. But Cosell, working locally for a kiddie show, it was called All League Clubhouse, and he just worked his way up. And the sports writers hated him. They used to knock the plug out of that tape recorder when he was in the clubhouse. They used to utter profanities into his microphone so that the tape would be unusable. He faced resistance right from the start, but he just kept moving up.
You write that even before most people knew who he was, Howard Cosell was, quote, an arrogance addict who seemed to have a knee-jerk reflex for cruelty. How and when did that become apparent?
That was always there. It was there when he was a law student at NYU. He used to walk around with his nose up in the air. And, you know, this was the way he was. He was a very imperious man. He always believed in himself, but it was driven by 1,001 insecurities, which date back to his childhood. But he was so driven, and he believed in his method so intensely that the force of his personality could not be stopped.
You characterize Howard Cosell as, quote, a speaker of truth, unafraid to offend those who might take offense. And you've talked a little bit about how his style was different from those who came before him. But what particular achievements as a reporter or as an interviewer led you to that conclusion?
When he stood up for Ali, on constitutional grounds, it wasn't based on opposition to Vietnam. It wasn't based on his color. Even his religion, it was based solely on constitutional grounds. It was a very fine line that Cosell had to draw, because after all, he's working for a big corporation. You know, the sponsors are very conservative people, and yet here he is, maybe the only journalist, certainly the only television journalist, to take Ali's side at a time when maybe, 90-95% of America just considered Ali a traitor, you know, who should be in jail and a commie and this whole thing. And later on, he did some really good, really fine journalistic work, especially when he had his show called Sports Beat toward the end of his career. He was a very, very good journalist. I mean, he wasn't always right, but he always took a stand. And for that, I really gave him tons of credit.
Howard Cosell was certainly a major force on Monday Night Football, which drew an enormous audience. And for years, he was a presence at virtually every major sports event and appeared as a guest on all sorts of sitcoms as well, playing himself for the most part. But how do you make the leap from that sort of achievement to, and I'm quoting you now, he was himself a social institution?
Because there was no bigger cultural icon in the 70s. He used to joke about it, maybe not even joking. He would say there was this holy trinity of TV icons in the 70s, Johnny Carson, Walter Cronkite, and himself. And I think he was right, because everywhere you turned in the 70s, as you just said, there was Cosell. He far transcended sports. When he would go on these sitcoms like The Odd Couple and, you know, the Dean Martin roasts and all that, all he was doing was playing himself. You know, he never had to play another role in his life. That's how strong that caricature was, that self-caricature. He was probably even more recognizable. You know the famous TV Guide poll that had him the most beloved and the most detested TV personality at the same time? It takes a real talent to do that, doesn't it? people would say they hate Cosell, but when is he on next? You know, and it takes a unique to the extreme talent to be able to pull that off.
Howard Cosell died in April of 1995. With the perspective of a decade and a half, describe his legacy for us.
His legacy is that we didn't know him. We didn't know his insecurities. We didn't know what drove him, because there's always something that drives a genius like that. I mean, that's a word that's used rather loosely, of course. But for what he did, he was certainly a genius. He was ahead of his time, and the fact is he took his time with him. When he died, he took his times with him, because nobody could follow that.
Mark Grabowski is the author of Howard Cosell, The Man, the Myth, and the Transformation of American Sports. The book is published by Norton, and the author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. It was terrific.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
Croatia has been plagued by droughts so severe that near Imotski, a town in the southern part of the country, a lake that would normally contain millions of gallons of reservoir water has dried up completely. In an attempt to make the best of a dusty situation, two soccer teams in Imotski recently staged a match at the bottom of the former lake. Fans used the reservoir observation platforms as grandstands as the two clubs played to a 4-4 draw. It was a result unlikely to satisfy supporters of either team, but as one spectator pointed out, at least it didn't rain. I know to you, it might sound strange, but I wish it would rain. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, an Ivy League professor goes all in for poker as a mind sport. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The Penn State University scandal has dominated the headlines this week. The investigation is widening as we speak. Some have called this the biggest story in the history of college sports. Have they got that right?
In its own completely miasmic, miserable, awful, hideous way, yes. It has all the elements in it to prove the case that the colleges ought to be out of this business forever. I have so much anger going in so many different directions, and some of them in the direction of my own profession. There is nothing here except the rape of children. There's nothing else. There's nothing else to talk about. Some coach's legacy, a bunch of idiot students who ought to be lucky they're not Occupy demonstrators because they'd have been beaten to the ground instead of just sort of arrested, some of them. College football, I don't care about any of that. The rape of children is the only thing you should care about here. And if we haven't learned that after 20 years of covering this in the Catholic Church, I don't know when we ever will.
Penn State, of course, has to respond to this. And there have been some people saying they should simply drop football.
I don't have a problem with them doing that, and if they do it, I would say you have atoned 30%, maybe even less than that, of what you allowed to happen in your athletic facilities under the auspices of your football program. This is so infinitely worse than point shaving, which has cost some schools their major programs. It's so infinitely worse than what happened at SMU, which cost them their football program for a year. It's so infinitely worse than any recruiting scandal or anything that's prompted a suspension. It's several orders of magnitude worse than anything schools have been punished for in the past regarding their athletic programs. If I were the Penn State trustees, and they would know better than I about this, but if I knew that there were other shoes to drop on this one, as I suspect there are, I would seriously consider eliminating the football program for a considerable space of time.
The NBA's latest proposal to its locked-out players consists of a 50-50 split of basketball-related income and a few assorted salary cap gewgaws and a 72-game schedule, which would begin on December 15th if it was accepted. The union will apparently put the latest proposal to vote early next week. What do you think? Will a vote go on this?
If I were a betting man, I would say it would probably pass. I'm sure the union will line up, you know, in its meetings with its players, will line up against this proposal because it's once again David Stern demanding everything when he's already got 80% of what he wants. But I suspect the rank and file will vote to go back to plan.
Meanwhile, Stephon Marbury referred to Michael Jordan as a sellout this week. What was that all about?
Well, Michael Jordan has been one of the hard bar owners in the negotiations here. Michael Jordan, who's never done a damn thing in his professional life with his money or his fame or his influence that didn't somehow profit Michael Jordan. Stephon Marbury will be ripped for being a goofball, but he told the truth on this one. Michael Jordan is a sellout, has been a sellout, and always will be a sellout.
Charlie, former heavyweight champion Joe Frazier died on Monday night. A lot of people remembering him as the guy who fought Muhammad Ali three times and beat him once. Is that your enduring image of Joe Frazier?
The enduring image I have of Joe Frazier is the first Ali fight, where he threw what is perhaps the most perfect punch in the history of boxing to knock Ali down late in the fight and win the decision. He was, of course, tormented. Muhammad Ali put demons in this man's head, for which Muhammad Ali will have to atone before whatever judgment is finally handed out to Muhammad Ali. He was a great fighter. He's a perfect example of what boxing can do to great people. He should be a cautionary tale for anybody who decides to take up that sport.
The NASCAR Cup Chase is still remarkably tight, with Carl Edwards holding a slim lead over Tony Stewart, I think 3 points going into the final two races of the season. Who takes this thing, Mr. NASCAR?
Well, let's see. I don't know. That's the actual truth. This is exactly what, of course, NASCAR had been hoping against hope for ever since it invented the chase for the cup. It's going to be one of those two guys. They've opened some daylight over Kevin Harvick in third place. I still think Tony Stewart's going to catch him, but I wouldn't bet on it.
At the Australian Open this week, Tiger Woods played his first bogey-free round in 9 months, and he was atop the leaderboard at the end of the second round. Is Tiger again playing at his peak?
Let's see when the tour comes back here in January and they start playing here whether he is. This is, of course, a promising sign, but he's certainly having a better day than John Daly did.
I was going to say, that. Otherwise that would have been the big story of that tournament.
Everybody's ever seen the movie Tin Cup will know this scene. Where Kevin Costner at the U.S. Open chooses instead to try to make an impossible shot and winds up getting a 12 on the last hole of the U.S. Open. John Daly was on the par 5 11th, hit 7 balls in a row into the water and gave up and left the course. If you're going to give up and leave the course, leave after the third shot or the fourth.
I'm just thinking, this has got to be one of these things where he had 6 extra golf balls in his bag, and one after another, he hit them all into the water and then went home, right? I mean, there has to be some intention here.
I've taken all I can stands, and I can't stands no more.
In 2006, Floyd Landis was stripped of his Tour de France title for doping. This week, things got worse for Landis, at least if he was ever thinking about returning to France. How so?
Yeah, he was indicted convicted in absentia for his role into a hacking thing where they got into the computers of the French doping lab. They were spying on the computer to get information from his file. As we always say, drugs make people stupid.
And finally, Charlie, I have long been aware of fantasy football and fantasy baseball, although I own no franchises in either. I had not previously been aware of fantasy fishing, but given the payouts available, I guess I should have been paying attention.
Yes, a woman won $100,000 playing fantasy fishing. This is an interesting. This is, and yes, I know. But Christy McNabb is not laughing because she's got 100 G's.
I know.
She admits. I mean, what you do is you draft the professional fishermen who are on this fishing tour, and you know, just as you would fantasy football, fantasy baseball. And I mean, personally, I like fish on rotisserie much better than baseball players. But that's neither here nor there. My favorite comment from Ms. McNabb, the champion, is that she said, I used to be on Facebook a lot, and I used to play Farmville all the time, and my dad talked me into playing fantasy fishing. I gave up Farmville because I had no more time for it. I can't waste any more time. My time-wasting time is precious.
It's all wasted.
I can't waste my time-wasting time on Farmville. I have to waste it on fantasy fishing where I can make
$100,000. Charlie Fierce writes the politics blog for Esquire magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Early Wednesday morning, Pius Hines beat out Martin Stashko to win the 2011 World Series of Poker. Hines takes home $8.7 million. Stashko pockets $5.4 million. The event was broadcast nearly live on ESPN2. The game has come a long way from smoke-filled back rooms and bar fights, but as Only a Game's Karen Given reports, some say there's still a lot of work to be done.
The money stays, and you go.
Close your eyes and think of poker, and this might be what you see. A smoke-filled, poorly lit room, a pair of gunslingers sitting over glasses of whiskey, and a debate over who's cheating that ends like this. Now forget Hollywood and think ESPN.
And now, Stashko all in and a call from Pius Hines.
As both players push all in on the final hand of this week's World Series of Poker final, Hines, a 22-year-old German in a pristine white hoodie, sips from a bottle of what looks like tomato juice, while the 35-year-old Czech, Stashko, sweats it out with water. When the cards are revealed and Hines is the winner, he runs into the arms of his parents while his gallery serenades him.
I mean, if anything, it looks like an incredibly boring place where you just, no drinks, no smoke, no bad language, no nothing.
Professor Charles Nesson has been on the faculty of Harvard Law School since 1966. He teaches evidence and internet, and as strange as it might sound, he is an advocate for the sport of poker.
It's time for it to shake loose from the awful reputation it built up through its genesis as a gambling game. It has had an equally distinguished history as an academic pursuit. It's the ideal model. It's one of the first models of economy.
Professor Nesson says strategic thinking, taking risks based on limited information, empathizing with an opponent, and even showing strength from a position of weakness are all skills vital for playing poker and practicing law. Through his poker reading group for first-year law students and the Harvard Poker Thinking Society, which he advises, he's brought the game of poker and its higher-level reasoning skills to countless Harvard Law students. But he's not done. He'd like to see parents play poker with their kids, and even...
So you'd like to see, I don't know, elementary school kids learning to play poker in class?
Absolutely. I mean, I'll get in trouble for it because people say, oh my God, the kids, we taught gambling. But yes, absolutely. You don't need to teach kids to play above their means. In fact, the whole thing you want to teach is exactly how to manage your stake. That's it. How do you manage your stake in life?
How do you make most with what you've got?
But how do you also keep from going bust?
Professor Nesson is working with the newly formed U.S. Poker Federation to separate the game of poker from its gambling past. The organization would like to see tournaments set up like any other sport, where participants are competing for sponsors' money and not their own. And they'd like to get the game added to the official roster of mind sports by the International Mind Sport Federation. It's a distinction currently reserved for chess, the Asian game of Go, draughts, which is a 10x10 form of checkers, and duplicate bridge. But Professor Nesson says there's one problem.
In order to qualify as a mind sport in this particular international conception of it, you have to be able to demonstrate that your game is capable of being played completely without chance. That is, completely as a game of skill.
To that end, Professor Nesson and his students at Harvard Law have tested duplicate poker, a form of the game that's played with teams of six players at six different tables with identically shuffled cards to diminish the role of luck. The game gets its first big showcase next week on the London Eye, Europe's largest Ferris wheel. Wednesday night at Harvard University's Queen's Head Pub, first-year law student Brian Koch has no doubt that poker is a game of skill. He should know. He's played in the World Series of Poker and was a full-time professional player for 2 years before coming to law school. He says poker teaches replicable logical thinking that's good for law and life.
So it's like, oh, you went on a bad date. Oh, you had a bad beat with that one, right? Like, things like that. Like, everything is spoken in poker lingo. And we joke about it, but it's like, in a way, it's true that you do want to look at the world that way and just continue to make correct decisions, and sometimes you're going to have negative outcomes. But the basic theory underlying all poker theory is that if you continue to make correct decisions, if you continue to take the 51% chance over the 49% chance over a large enough sample over a long enough time, that's going to come out in your favor, and you're going to end up better off.
Not all of Harvard Law's poker players are experienced at the game. Graduate law student Barbara Sabalska pulls out her illustrated poker cheat sheet, which makes Hector Ramos, the second year to her right, think he can take her.
Well, yes, actually. And the great thing is, since she's sitting next to me, I can look at it also.
Ramos has only played poker once before, but he has no doubt that tonight's game is more than just a break from his studies. It's an important part of his education.
All of us have a little fighter inside us, but we have to know when it's the time to fight and when it's the time to back away. And whether you're a lawyer litigating or you're a businessman trying to find a deal, these skills apply to everything you do in life, I think.
Can everyone shuffle?
Well, not so much. Even former pro Brian Koch, who did most of his poker playing online, isn't the world's best shuffler. But while the shuffling might not be top-notch, the intellectual debate led in the Socratic style by Professor Nesson is.
I'm looking for the progression of thought. All right, the flop comes, bang. What do you? How does the mind work?
Well, you know, it's everything's player-dependent, right? So first it depends on your opponent. It depends on what happened.
Koch talks about the texture of the table. He uses phrases like hand range, pot control, and straight value. For Koch, poker is clearly an academic pursuit.
Poker players have, like, aggregated all the theory and reasoning now, so where we're all thinking on a different level. The bad players now are better than the good players were 10 years ago. And it's not even close. It's not even close.
Still, while a batter in his second ever at-bat isn't going to have a chance against a pro pitcher, on this night, former pro Brian Koch is facing a strong challenge from this guy.
It's me and you, sir. The old vet and the newcomer.
Well, I have played twice, so...
Hector Ramos and Brian Koch trade the chip lead a few times, while other members of the Harvard Poker Thinking Society start to complain that they need to get back to studying. Ramos gets impatient and tries to go all in on a couple of questionable hands, but Koch stays steady and waits for the right cards.
This is the end.
I'm all in.
Yes! So I'm all in also in.
I have a boat.
Oh, no! No!
Koch beams and says even though there was no money at stake, he was very happy to come out on top. With the precision of a pro, he calculates that his odds of winning tonight started at just 30%. Koch doesn't just think in terms of what the game of poker can do for law students. He's also thinking about what law students can do for the game of poker.
You know, the timing for poker players to be in law school couldn't be more perfect given that online poker was recently made illegal. There's a lot of legal work to be done in the United States at this moment.
Those who choose to take up that charge will have an ally in Professor Charles Nesson. He says he's looking forward to the day when he can once again sit in bed playing online poker on his laptop while his wife Fern sits next to him enjoying her crossword puzzle. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
That was a lot of fun. Thank you for having us.
Well done, Brian.
Thank
Very
you.
Good job.
Thank you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Thanks to Jill Ryan at Here and Now. Our intern is Jillian Guybe. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen Given's poker photo gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.